your bed on.
Good morning, friends, and welcome to KFAR Radio's Meet a Pioneer. Today is February 15th, 1985. I'm Gail Malloy. Each Friday morning at 9 o'clock, we meet a pioneer. We'll spend the next hour with Celia Hunter. She's best known for her work in conservation and as a pioneer woman aviator. This morning's presentation is sponsored by Denali Chiropractic Clinic, Larson's Jewelers, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank, Two Rivers Lodge, Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, the Riverboat Discovery, and Sophie Station. And now Paul Rosenthal's variation on Alaska's flag song. My guest this morning on Meet a Pioneer, Celia Hunter. She was born on January 13th in 1919, which makes her KFAR's favorite number, 66 years old. 66. The thing that fascinates me most about what you're known for, that we're going to find out a lot about today, is being a pioneer woman aviator. Celia, when was the first time you flew in an airplane?
Well, I flew in an airplane back in 1924, so I'm told. I don't remember the flight very well because I was about 5 years old, but a barnstorming ex-World War I pilot came to Arlington, Washington with an old Jenny, just like the one that's hanging out in the airport today, and I went for a ride in it with my mother. My father wouldn't get into the contraption. So I started off at an early age on wings.
Well, later on, did your mother, what was her description of that sort of a flight? Now, she was old enough to remember and appreciate that.
Oh, she loved it. She thought it was just great.
Now, that's an open cockpit plane.
Oh, you bet. You had to put on a helmet and goggles.
Now, all I've seen is stuff like that, like you say, hanging in the airport in the movies, and that just fascinating. Now, when was the first time you flew that you remember that you fell in love with it?
Well, that was probably in 1940. I was working at Weyerhaeuser Timber Company in Everett, Washington, and I had to drive by the little airport in the Delta country between Marysville, Washington, and Everett, Washington. And I kept looking at those little airplanes, and I kept thinking about Amelia Earhart, who was my girlhood heroine. And finally, I stopped by to find out if I could learn to fly. After all, I was making $90 a month as an invoice clerk. And they fell on me because at that time I didn't realize how hard up pilots were for a little business. You see, private flying was just beginning in the late 1930s and the around 1940. After all, Cubs, Aroncas, T-Craft, the Piper, C3 and all those sorts of things only were developed in the latter part of the 30s. Before that, they all had biplanes and open cockpits and that sort of thing. And these were little cabin planes, and they were light. The plane that I learned to fly in was a T-craft. The first flight I took was in this little Taylor craft, which probably had a 65 horsepower engine or less, and it could go 50 to 60 miles an hour at top speed, and if it got into a headwind, it stood still over the ground. But that was a marvelous flight because it was done in January. I remember January 20th, 1940 was the first time I went up and actually got hold of the controls, and it was a beautiful clear day in western Washington, and you can imagine what it's like flying around in that over the sound and looking at the mountains, and I just thought it was great.
Oh,
so
my
I
word.
Said, I will learn to fly. For $75, they would solo you. So it took me 4 months to earn to get $75 that I could pay him. But I did, and on April 1st, they soloed.
Oh, my word. Well, let's back up just a minute, back to 1919. Now, where were you born, and where'd you grow up?
Well, I was born in Arlington, Washington, in the most beautiful county in Washington State, Snohomish County. It's about 50 miles or a little better north of Seattle. It's right in the foothills of the Cascades. And I lived there until I was about 13, and then my family lost the house. Like, it was the start of the Depression, and like most people, they went broke, and the bank came in and took the house away. So we ended up living on a little shack that my mother owned on 15 acres of land down at Getchell Hill. The conjunction of Getchell Hill and Whiskey Ridge. It was called Whiskey Ridge because most of the hill people down there had been moonshiners during Prohibition days.
Okay.
And I graduated from high school in Marysville. And then I went to business college in Everett because my family couldn't afford to send me to college. And they said, well, you go to business college, you get a job, you can go to college on your own. And I finally did.
Well, you graduated, what, about 37 or 8?
36.
36. To what extent did being a teenager and growing up in the Depression years, coming out of the 20s and the Depression years, have an influence on what you ended up doing in your life? It must have had some.
Well, I think that most of the people I know who lived through the Depression came out of it with one of two attitudes toward life, toward money, and that sort of thing. For some people, and for many people, it was a terrifying experience, and they determined that they would never be poor again, and that they would not let their children be poor, and they concentrated on making money because they felt that money was a buffer against all the hardships of life. And the rest of us, and my friend Jenny and I, both had the same reaction to it, even though our families got very, very poor. In fact, my family had to go on relief at one point because my dad, who was a truck driver, broke his arm right in the middle of the Depression and was laid up for quite a while. But what we came out of it with was the feeling that, gosh, you can survive. You know, it's not that bad. Being broke isn't the worst thing in the world that can happen to you, and you're free. And it's really given us a tremendous amount of freedom because you know that you can make out no matter what happens, no matter if you lose your job, if you're on your uppers, that you've got enough ingenuity and enough whatever it takes to get by, because we found out that people did.
Well, it sounds like that sense of adventure sort of gave you some confidence to do some of the things that we're going to hear about in the next few minutes here. Now, you were pretty young when you took a trip, and there's so many things, it's hard for me to separate all your different adventures, but you took a trip abroad and wrote back to your local newspaper a series of articles. Tell us about that and when it was.
Well, that was after I had, after the war. I had gone through the war and had actually been to Alaska before I went abroad.
Oh, I see.
But it was my hometown newspaper, the Everett Daily Herald, which took a flyer on my writing ability. I walked in and told them I was going to go over and go to school at the University of Stockholm and travel around Europe, and I'd like to write articles for them. And they said, sure. So I kept sending back about two or three articles a week from all over Europe. We started out in at the University of Stockholm. It was an American college there, which was catering to GI students. Jenny and I didn't have any GI privileges because we served in the wrong military branch or unmilitary branch during World War II. But we had enough money saved up, and so we went to Sweden, and then we got bored with the Scandinavian countries, or certainly with Sweden, because it hadn't been touched by the war, and we started out to see Europe. Went to Austria and skied for about a month, and minimal money and minimal food, because they didn't have very much food in Austria at that time. And then we went down to Italy and bought bicycles, and ended up traveling for 10 months by bicycle, train, ferry boat, and train all over Western Europe from Italy clear up to Finnish Lapland, and then down the Norwegian coast to the British Isles, and finally wound up going back up to Norway and hitching a ride home on a Norwegian oil tanker.
Hitching a ride home on you two girls, late 40s, hitching a ride home on a Norwegian oil tanker.
Yeah.
Did you encounter any problems or any difficulties you had in the trip?
No, you know, it was amazing. The this was post-war Europe, and I think Europe had so much violence, and so it was so just completely laid out by the war and the suffering that everybody over there had gone through, that it was a very non-violent time to be traveling there. We had no incidents of any problems at all. It was a far safer time to be in Europe than today.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't have, there were no terrorists, there weren't any people like that. You had a lot of displaced persons. We stayed in youth hostels, and we had, for company, we had people from Estonia and Lithuania and Latvia and Czechoslovakia, all many of whom could never go home again. They had just lost their homeland, they'd lost their families, they'd lost even the fruits of whatever education they had, and they were displaced persons. The only hope they had was to get a Nansen passport, which was the universal passport at that time, which was given to displaced persons, and then they'd have to find some country that would take them in. So we didn't, we had a lot of interesting incidents, but no catastrophes or anything like that. We slept in haystacks. We slept in little Swiss hay huts. We slept on the decks of boats when we were traveling by boat. It was a very interesting time, and we were perfectly free. We had our packs on our backs and our bicycles, and we went wherever we felt like.
Now, we're going to talk about the conservation aspect of your life a little bit more later, but I noticed in reading some of the articles on you, you made a statement that you didn't always think, I don't think I was always an environmentalist. I just happened a little at a time. Did some of that start on that trip abroad?
Well, I don't know. You know, you have to stop and think that the environmental movement per se didn't really get going in this country until around the late 50s and around the early 60s. There were organizations like the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society. Prior to that, the Wilderness Society was founded in 1935, actually, to try to preserve wilderness, because they realized they were starting to put a road through the Blue Ridge, over the Blue Ridge Mountains, and that really freaked out some of the people who loved those wild ridges and so on, so they organized to protect them. And the Sierra Club started out as an outing club. The Sierra Club was mostly dedicated to getting people out in the wilderness one way or another by backpacking and skiing, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. And they just gradually worked into conservation as we know it. So the tendencies you have, one of the main tendencies of conservationists, I think, is frugality. You don't like to spend more than you need to, and you like to conserve things, and you want to make things last as long as possible, and that's the beginning of conservation.
And that's the way you traveled.
And that's the way we traveled. We could stretch a penny farther than practically anybody.
Well, we're going to come back in just a moment after this break and go back to the aviation part of your life and pick up from there. Back in just a moment on Meet a Pioneer with Celia Hunter.
20 years ago, Mount McKinley Bank was founded by a group of forward-looking individuals who saw a need in the community. The new bank offered low-interest loans to encourage new home building in the Fairbanks area. It was an immediate success. Today, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is still located at 530 4th Avenue in the same building where founder Julian Rice and first president Judge Vernon Forbes served on the first board of trustees. The bank has seen a lot of history, and their solid background of investment and involvement in the community has earned Mount McKinley their own place in Fairbanks history. Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is proud to sponsor Meet a Pioneer. At Mount McKinley, they're looking forward to a future as proud as their past.
Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by Interior Signs, long established as one of the interior's most professional, most dependable year-round sign makers. They're licensed, insured, and always ready to serve Fairbanks with signs of every kind. Signs for business, contracting, or creative design. So for signs that stand the test of time, call Interior Signs at 479-3859. That's 479-3859. Interior Signs at 2405 South Cushman.
Alaska's pioneering spirit will never die. It lives on in second and third generation Alaskans like Dr. Carol Davis of Denali Chiropractic Clinic.
Sponsoring Meet a Pioneer gives Carol an opportunity to show her pride in being an Alaskan and in being a member of the world's largest drugless healing profession. Becoming a chiropractor meant years of demanding study, a period of internship, and then meeting tough licensing standards. She's happy to talk about chiropractic with anyone interested in learning more about it. Just call 479-0485 or stop by and see Carol at 3525 College Road.
Thank you, Dr. Davis of Denali Chiropractic Clinic. And now back to our program, Meet a Pioneer.
Celia Hunter in the studios with me this morning. Celia Hunter, we're going to go back to that experience where you first had that flight that you remember, the one you remember that put the love of flying in your blood. But before we move from there, no, there is a person in your life that kind of shared that pioneer aviation. You mentioned her several times this morning. I think we need to define and find out who is Ginny.
Well, that's Ginny Hill Wood, who became my partner in starting and operating Camp Denali, and who also learned to fly back in 1940 in the old college, the CPTP. That was the...
CPTP?
Oh, yes, the... I can't think what it is, just a minute. Anyway, that was a CPTP course that was sponsored by the government in order to train pilots. In the time before we entered the war, 1940, we were still trying to stay neutral. So they had a program in all of the colleges and so on where they would take people and put them through the ground school work, and then they had classes of 10 students each, 9 men and 1 woman. And so they would go through the training course, and then they would get a private ticket out of it. And at the same time that I was learning, I learned to fly. First of all, I soloed on my own, but then I got into the non-college CPTP program in Everett, Washington, and at the same time, she was going through the one at the University of Washington. We'd never met, except that after we got our privates, most women pilots knew something about each other if they were in the same vicinity, and we both were in the Pacific Northwest and ran into each other occasionally. But we went to Sweetwater and were in different classes. Sweetwater was the training center for the women Air Force service pilots in Texas, down in West Texas. It's close to Abilene. And so we went through the WAS training at the same time, but she was a class ahead of me and went to Long Beach, which was her base, and I went clear back east to Wilmington, Delaware. And we'd run into each other on the very different airports around the country. Mm-hmm. But we didn't start doing any flying for the same outfit until after the war, when we were flaring surplus airplanes out of storage depots all over the West into Portland, Oregon. And that was where we You had to pick up a buddy because the airplanes that we were flying were so cruddy. They'd been on, you know, they'd been stored for years, and many of them didn't have instruments that operated, and they had engines might quit at any time, and it was a little hairy. So you had a buddy, and
your buddy was flying in a different plane.
In a different plane, you bet. But so they knew where you went down, and they would go and get help if you needed it. This was.
Well, did that bother you? Did anything like that ever happen?
Oh, we had with some of our planes. I had a forced landing at one point, and my engine quit. But I happened to be over Sydney, Nebraska. We were flying from North Platte, Nebraska, into Cheyenne, Wyoming, and we were just flying along, and we're not thinking about anything. We'd been told not to land at Sydney, Nebraska, because the field was so muddy. It was just an auxiliary field. It wasn't a real airport. And they said the field's got several inches of mud on it because it had been having very heavy rainstorms. And he said, now just don't land there. Well, when my engine started popping black smoke and losing power, I didn't have much choice. So I went down and landed in Sydney, Nebraska. So Jenny was flying with me, and she had seen the smoke pouring out of the engine before I did.
Oh, my word.
And so she came down and landed too, and pretty soon the other girls in the flight came along, and they looked down, saw the two airplanes down there, thought they were supposed to land, and everybody landed. And finally, the mechanic and flight chief who was along with us, Jack Mifflin, came flying over, looked down, saw all these airplanes down there. So he came in, too. And here we all were in this muddy old cow pasture with a bunch of horses running around. And,
my word.
I finally left him with my airplane and borrowed it. I took his airplane, and we flew off and left him to repair it. Anyway, it was quite successful. There was no problem.
Gee.
But you had, things like that could happen.
Well, flying like that, you made a living at that?
Oh, yeah. Well, sort of. We were getting about $200 a month. You have to realize that we flew the entire war with the flight pay of a second lieutenant, which was either $200 or $250 a month. I don't remember which.
Huh.
But we were paid by civil service. We were never militarized. The WASP were never militarized. And we finally got honorable discharges long in either 1978 or 1979.
Oh, my goodness. Any other particular experiences or flying like that during the war that you remember?
We had a lot of interesting trips, but mostly we were, I can remember when I started checking out in pursuits down at Brownsville, Texas. You see, I was in the ATC, which is the Air Transport Command, and it was the fairing division of the Air Transport Command that the WASP were working with mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And we ferried airplanes. We started out ferrying Cubs, and then gradually we were given training to work our way up through all kinds of heavier aircraft. And they would always say that, this is an airplane the WASP can't fly, and then they would assign one of our top WASP pilots to fly it, and she'd fly it without any problem, and then it would become the kitty car of the air, and they'd go on, you know. In fact, WASP were qualified on everything, including the B-24s and the B-29s before the war ended.
What's a WASP?
Women Air Force Service Pilot.
Women Air Force Service Pilot.
Yeah.
Well, tell us the story. Now, I know you and Jenny had an amazing trip up the Inside Passage, which is what got you to Fairbanks, Alaska.
Now, well, not that? Really. We didn't. The trip on the Inside Passage was in a sailboat.
Oh, I see.
This was after the war.
Okay, well, what's the story of the flight you made?
Oh, well, that was, you see, we started for Alaska in the sailboat, but we didn't get here because it was so interesting coming up the Inside Passage, and we went into every fjord along the way. So we spent 3 months and only got as far north as the end of Vancouver Island.
Now, how did a sailboat, you and Jenny decide to take a sailboat? I don't.
Well, you have to realize that we have lots of interest. In the, as a matter of fact, one of the things that we especially like to do was ski, except I didn't know how to ski until after World War II, and we went up to Mount Baker and got a cabin that was buried under 30 feet of snow before the winter ended, and we stayed up there the whole winter, and that's where I learned to ski. In the meantime, Jenny saved her money like a good little brick during the war, and had bought she'd always wanted a sailboat, so she went down, and this was in 1945, late 1945, and bought this little 26-foot Seabird yawl, and it had an auxiliary motor, and despite the fact that she was a pilot, she hates engines. She doesn't have any. She says no rapport with them at all. So I happen to like engines. So she said, "Hey, why don't you go sailing with me, and you can be the engineer?" Well, that sounded great. You know, I had never gone sailing. So we got another ex-WASP who came from Missouri, and she'd never been in anything bigger than a rowboat on the Mississippi River. So she came out and joined us, and the three of us went cruising up the inside passage all by ourselves, which really confounded the males who were piloting their big motorboats and that sort of thing, because they just couldn't conceive that we didn't have a man aboard to do everything.
Well, this is 1945. You girls are all in your mid-20s. How big is this sailboat?
26 feet. Only slept two, so one of us had to sleep on deck most of the time.
My gosh. Well, how long did this trip take?
Well, we spent 3 months cruising in the sailboat.
And
as I say, we didn't get very far because we just found too many places to stop and enjoy, you know, little fishing villages. And we went up to Princess Louisa Inlet, and we did things like that. So.
And this was the first time you'd seen this area, so you were just having a good time.
Well, we had all the proper books in our cockpit, including the engine manual. I really didn't know that
the
much
engine
about
manual.
But we had a tide table, and we had the Pacific Coast Pilot, and we had books on sailing. Ginny had sailed before on a little boat, not a big one, but we got along fine. We went aground the first time we tried to sail at night, and after that we decided, well, we're daytime sailors, so that was what we did.
My gosh.
But that was a side trip, and we got back, and we still wanted to go to Alaska. In fact, we all three made a pact that we would go to Alaska, because when we got to Victoria, we got mail. Pete found out that her boyfriend had married somebody else, and Ginny found out that the fellow she was supposed to fly for in Seattle had killed himself in an airplane wreck, and I was offered a really wonderful job with the Weyerhaeuser Timber Company. They had... One of the executives kept thinking about me because I had quit them when I was an invoice clerk, and told him no way, because I didn't think there was any future in the timber industry then. I still don't think there's any future for women. But
Now, wait a minute. You're an invoice clerk.
That was when I learned to fly.
Now, at the time, though, did you ever entertain the notion that maybe that's what you were always going to do, or what did you think you were going to grow up and be at that time?
Well, I never had any idea what I was going to grow up and be, but when I looked at the woman sitting across the desk from me who'd been an invoice clerk for 15 years, I said, oh, no way, and I quit. So I got out of the timber business. And when I got back to a job, well, I was flying. And and then we started to go to, as I say, we started up to Alaska, but didn't make it, so... We still wanted to get there, so a friend of mine was selling surplus airplanes in Seattle, and I called him up and said, hey, George, have you got a plane going to Alaska? And he said, I just so happen to have. So we went down, I went down and talked to the Gene Jack. Some people who are listening may remember Gene Jack, who was a miner. He was out at Candle with Robbins at the gold mine out in the Candle area, and that's where he'd learned to fly. And he had decided... at that point that he wanted to set up a trading post in a roadhouse in Kotzebue in competition with old Archie Ferguson. So he was out in Seattle. This was 1946. He was in Seattle picking up airplanes and various stuff to stock his trading post in Kotzebue. And so I hired on to fly a Gullwing Stinson north for him, and I asked if my friend could go too, and he said, well, can she fly? And I said, sure. So he said, oh, well, I'll get another airplane. So he did. So we had three airplanes. His was a twin-engine Cessna, and then I had the Gullwing Stinson, and Ginny had a little old L5, which we call Little Igloo because it didn't have any heat but lots of ventilation.
Oh, my word. We're going to hear more about this on Meet a Pioneer with Celia Hunter, back in a moment after these acknowledgments of our sponsors.
Today's Alaskans are demanding more. More style, more options, more flexibility, and more for their money. And they're finally getting it from Sophie's Station, Fairbanks' newest, most attractive contemporary living complex. Sophie's Station is a prestige...
Alaskans have always been famous for their hospitality. The same wonderful hospitality you still find at the Two Rivers Lodge, where Don and Stasha Troutman offer the best menu and interior, a comfortable, quiet atmosphere, and that famous Alaskan welcome to the people who are today's history makers. If you've been meaning to try one of the most talked about dining experiences in the Alaskan interior, don't wait any longer. Go out tonight to the Two Rivers Lodge, 16 Mile Chena Hot Springs Road.
Alaska is still a land of pioneers, like the Binkley family, who for three generations have operated riverboats in the state of Alaska.
Running the riverboat Discovery has given our family the opportunity to show so many others just a little corner of the Alaska we love. That's also one of the reasons we're proud to be a sponsor of Meet a Pioneer. This program gives us all a chance to find out more about the fascinating history of this special place we call Alaska, and we look forward to each week's program. We're looking forward to seeing you again next summer aboard the riverboat Discovery.
Okay, we're back with Celia Hunter on Meet a Pioneer. Well, Celia, you called up a fellow. Turns out he had a plane. He had one for your friend, and you're going to fly him into Alaska. Let's pick up at that point in the story.
Well, you know, it was kind of interesting because this all started about September of 1946, which is not a bad month to head north to Alaska.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, we were not aware of anything about the weather in Alaska and the winter in Alaska or anything like that. We'd only been temperate zone pilots so far. The Jean Jack had lots of irons in the fire, and he sent us out to do all sorts of things. This was kind of interesting. He'd get an idea, and Rollie Livesley was his partner in a lot of this stuff. And Rollie Livesley used to run the Fairbanks Cold Storage. Anybody who remembers Fairbanks in the 40s will remember the Cold Storage. It was at Wickersham and Second or something like that. Anyway, they were down there in Seattle dreaming up ways to make money because the Alaska steamship was out on strike just then. So they decided to buy a truck, a big semi, and send it up the highway with liquor and meat and all kinds of things to make money. And so he just said, well, why don't you girls go out and see if you can whether this is a good truck or not. He found one in the want ads, and so we went out and we looked at it, and we didn't know anything about trucks, but it looked good, so we said, okay. And he sent us out to get a darkroom outfit for his trading post in Kotzebue, because he decided that was how he'd make some money. You know, he'd sell cameras to the Eskimos and then anyway, and we bought calico for Parkies. We'd never seen a cuss puck in our life, but we were out buying calico to make cuss pucks for the Eskimos in Kotzebue. And at one point, he asked us if we were checked out on B-17s. Well, Ginny had checked out on a B-17 at one time in the ferry command. And he said, well, I was thinking about buying a B-17 and sending it up there. We said, no way. not us. But so we had to do a lot of work on the airplanes and so on. So it was getting on into November, and we still hadn't left Seattle.
Oh, my.
And finally, it was December 8th of 1946 that we headed north for Fairbanks. Now, Gene, he'd been up here through many winters, and that was nothing to him. And he threw a fire pot in my airplane, and he said, now, this is how we start the airplane when it gets cold. And I said, with that thing? And he said, oh, yeah. And he went through a quick rundown of what you do with a fire pot. Do you know what a fire pot is?
I have no idea.
Well, a fire pot is an oversized plumber's, it's a Primus stove. It's operated with gasoline, and it's a great big thing. And it makes a very hot flame. And to warm airplanes up when you don't have a Nelson heater, you know, electricity or anything like that, you put a big canvas hood over the engine of your aircraft, and you take this fire pot and you fire it up and you stick it in there under the canvas hood, and it warms up the airplane. You see, it's just like a tent, and ultimately the engine oil gets warm and you can turn the prop and you can get started.
But gosh. We'd
never even heard of the things, and he said, oh, well, he said, don't worry about it. He had a mechanic with him who was going to go fly with him to Alaska, and I had the mechanic's wife. Well, the mechanic's wife had been a bus driver in Seattle during the war. I don't remember what her name was. She was a real Rosie the Riveter type. And she chewed gum, and she came out to the airport in velveteen slacks and open-toed wedgies to fly to Alaska in December.
No kidding.
Ginny and I, of course, had sheepskin boots, and we had sheepskin jackets and pants and everything. We were really equipped.
Uh-huh.
And when we got to Edmonton, he said, you go get some clothes, because if we go down, I'm not going to give you mine. So she went and got some decent clothes to wear. But anyway, he told us that the Les, or whatever his name was, would be the one who'd operate the fire pot, and we wouldn't have to worry about it. Well, he and Les took off and left us behind. We went into Dawson Creek, and he flew over the top of a storm and went into Fort St. John, and we never saw him again.
And so before he left, did he instruct you in how to use
this?
Oh,
no. It was in the airplane. And we tried to get it started, and it flared up every time we put it out in cold weather. It didn't operate in cold weather, unfortunately. So we took it to a plumber in Dawson Creek, and he said, oh, yeah. He said, those things are made for the tropics. He said, here, I'll fix it. And so he fixed it so it would run in cold weather.
Oh, my word.
So we learned how to fire pot airplanes, and we gassed airplanes, sat on the wing of the airplane and poured gas into the tank with out of 5 gallon tins at 30 below zero. And
now you're 26 years old.
Roughly.
What do people think when they see these girls, you know, young women, these pilots flying around there? It's not even totally familiar with all the things she's doing. Did you get some funny reactions?
Oh, I suppose we did. I don't remember anybody making any comments. We took care of ourselves.
It didn't seem unusual to you.
No, we got along fine, and the pilots are very, very accepting lot, usually.
Uh-huh.
And if you can fly and you're on your own, they give you a hand if you need it, and they don't mind telling you the tricks of the trade, you know.
Uh-huh.
We learned a lot on that trip. We talked to a lot of pilots, and we'd find out how you did this or how you did that in the cold weather, because we were just we were completely out of our element. We didn't have any idea what you did and when it got to be 30 and 40 below zero, but we sure learned.
This is just fascinating. I just can just picture you girls doing this. Exciting. Well, then what? Okay.
Well, we stopped. It took us 27 days to get to Seattle, because we stopped 3 or 4 days almost every place we landed. You see, I don't know whether people remember, I'm sure Alaska Link and people like that remember the winter of 46-47, which was one of the worst Alaska's ever had. They have periods of 3 weeks at a time up here when it would be 50 below zero or colder, and they did that. I think there were 3 different periods that winter that were like that, and in between it would be up, you know, it'd get up to 20 or minus 20 or minus 15 or something like that, and then it'd get cold again. So we were heading north, you see, heading into all this weather, and we had, it was fairly stormy along the way part of the time, so every place we landed, we had to stop and wait out weather, and we only had about 3 or 4 hours of daylight, you see, in December to fly in, and that was another hazard that nobody'd ever warned us about.
Oh,
we didn't realize how dark it was up here in the wintertime, we could make about one hop a day.
Uh-huh.
And,
so 27 days.
Yes. We finally got to Northway for New Year's Eve. And
what'd you do on New Year's Eve?
Well, we went to a party. We didn't want to. We were exhausted. We'd flown all the way from Watson Lake to Whitehorse to Northway because we wanted to get to Alaska the same year we started. I don't know why.
I'm going to take I've got a photograph of you from an article, Celia Hunter, Portrait of an Activist. That is cute. Now, is that about the time you made that trip, about how old you were?
Yeah, that was about 2 years earlier.
Now, what kind of plane was that?
Well, the one in that picture is a P-47, a Thunderbolt.
And you've got your headphones on, and your hair has got the 1940s style.
You bet.
Swooped up at the edge. I mean, even on the plane, you got your hair style, and there's a big smile. This photograph embodies the adventure we're hearing about. Okay, so you spend New Year's Eve at a party.
Well, it was our first introduction to a Alaska New Year's Eve, and it was wild. We finally begged off at 2 o'clock in the morning and went back to crawl into bed because we had to get to Fairbanks the next day. We were getting tired of being on the road, and we thought we ought to get there.
Uh-huh.
I think Jean Jack thought we ought to get there, too. Incidentally, the Tundra Topics program that you were talking about, that was an old KFAR show, every night they had a bulletin on where Jean Jack's 2 lady pilots were. We got to Fairbanks, and we found that we were very well known.
No kidding. There's people listening right now that probably remember those. And you're those girls. Gee whiz.
But we finally got to Fairbanks and landed in a snowstorm. the snowstorm and the airplanes arrived at the same time, and so we cruised around. We almost landed at Creamer's Dairy because it was a nice big open space. We thought maybe that was the airport, but then we discovered it was a silo instead of the tower.
Oh, my.
So then we went on. We did find the airport.
January 1st, 1947.
Right.
You landed in Fairbanks at, was that Weeksfield?
Weeksfield.
And Weeksfield is?
Right out on the edge of town. It's where, it's just beyond 9th Avenue.
The edge of town,
mm-hmm.
Where the pizza pub, isn't that the hangar near?
Well, the Arctic Bowl is
the Arctic
old
Bowl
Pan Am hangar.
And that's where you landed.
Yep.
For those who are fairly new to the area, that was the edge of town, and there were about 5,000 people in Fairbanks about that time?
Yeah, there were about 5,000 people, and it was a delightful town. We just fell in love with the place. It was incredible because it was so friendly, and so many log cabins scattered around the streets, and nobody locked their doors. Everybody's house was open. You know, if somebody might be going by and be cold and they have to stop in, well, you know, you'd stop in. And we went to the USO and went out skiing at Birch Hill, and we were interviewed, incidentally, on KFAR by Chuck West, who at that point had quit Ween Airlines. He'd been the traffic manager for Ween Airlines, and he was just starting the Arctic Alaska Travel Service. And he had this program called Wings Over the North. It was a 15-minute show every Wednesday evening, I think. And when we landed in town, he thought, oh, boy, this is great. So he called us into the studio, and we were interviewed. And when we were having coffee afterwards, we got talking about flying and about airlines and all that sort of thing. And he discovered that because we'd been ferry pilots during the war, we knew a lot about airline routes because we'd always gone back. We had a Class 2 priority on the airlines as WASP, and we would be flown back to our bases to pick up another airplane and get in the air immediately, you know, to ferry it. So that was the kind of information that anybody working in a travel agency really needs, and there was nobody else in town, so he hired me as his office girl and Ginny to run the air cargo, and we started in with the Arctic Alaska Travel Service down on First Avenue where, what's the name of the restaurant keeps changing its name, you know. You know where the USO is.
Yes.
Well,
oh,
right next door to the
sure.
USO.
Oh.
And there was a little false front shack down there, and that was Chuck West's first office, right behind the Lathrop building. And eventually we moved into the Empress Theater building, which is where the Co-op Drug is now.
Now, when you came up here, were you planning on getting jobs and living here?
Heavens, no. We came up to look around. And matter of fact, we didn't stay long that time. We stayed only about 8 months in 1947, and then we went to Europe.
And then's the trip you told us about a little bit ago.
Yeah.
I mean, you got jobs and then you up and left, decided you're going to
go. Well, it was that kind of a time. We were we met a lot of the kids out at the university. The university was full of GIs who'd tried to go to colleges in the lower 48 when they got back from the war and couldn't stand the big schools, and so they'd come up to the University of Alaska. It was a wild place, let me tell you. You can imagine trying to be a house mother to a bunch of ex-GIs who just weren't about to take any orders from anybody. They were cooking in their rooms, and you know, it was just a really a great scene out there. And everybody was going on an adventure for that summer. Some of our student friends were going to climb Mount McKinley, including Gordon Herod, who's still here. He runs the Pearl Creek Strawberry Farm now, but he was a student at the university at that time, and he and a couple of other fellows were going to climb Mount McKinley, and they fixed all of their own food. They made erbswurst, you know, pea soup. They were drying it on their stove. They lived in a room right behind the old club dorm. People will remember the old club dorm on campus. They had the caretakers or some kind of a maintenance room that they got. They had been living in a Quonset hut down on Vulture Flats, which is where the Pearl Creek School is now. Yeah, it's been a long time since anybody called that Vulture Flats.
Vulture Flats. Golly. I want to clarify something to make sure. Now, some of my other guests on Meet a Pioneer have talked about those ferry pilots. Now, those are the planes that were brought from other areas to Fairbanks where the Russian pilots.
Oh, yeah.
And you were one of a ferry pilot.
I was a ferry pilot, but you see, the unfortunate thing was that it's just like the military still keeps claiming that they don't have facilities for women, and so they can keep them from having various jobs. In our era, They claimed that they didn't have any facilities for women on the Northwest Staging Route, which was the route from Great Falls up through Edmonton and Dawson Creek and Fort Nelson and Watson Lake and so on to Fairbanks. And that was why Ginny and I wanted to fly that route, because we'd been forbidden to fly it during the war. And at that time, see, we brought our airplanes as far as Great Falls, and then we had to turn them over to fellows who would fly them to Fairbanks, where very often women, Russian ferry pilots, would come into Fairbanks, pick the airplanes up, fly them west through Galena and Nome and across Siberia. So it was, and we missed out on that because we couldn't get to Fairbanks during the war.
Amazing. We'll be back with Celia Hunter on Meet a Pioneer.
20 years ago, Mount McKinley Bank was founded by a group of forward-looking individuals who saw a need in the community. The new bank offered low-interest loans to encourage new home building in the Fairbanks area. It was an immediate success. Today, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is still located at 530 4th Avenue in the same building where founder Julian Rice and first president Judge Vernon Forbes served on the first board of trustees. The bank has seen a lot of history, and their solid background of investment and involvement in the community has earned Mount McKinley their own place in Fairbanks history. Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is proud to sponsor Meet a Pioneer. At Mount McKinley, they're looking forward to a future as proud as their past.
Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop. Sam and Jane McConkie believe beautiful things are timeless, and everything you find at the Forget-Me-Not shop is beautiful. Fine linens, silver, crystal, decorator items for your home or office, and that little something for special friends. Forget-Me-Not adds a feeling of luxury to even the most practical items. So, for beautiful things for years to come, for your friends. He had big dreams of what he'd like his business to become. Over the years, some of those dreams changed and others came true. Today, Larson's is still a family-owned business and one of the finest and most complete jewelry stores in the interior. Almost 40 years of skill and experience go into everything they do. Like Fairbanks, they've grown, but they're still your friend and neighbor. Larson's, fine jeweler since 1946 at 405 Noble.
Is waiting for you.
This has been a quick hour. We have 8 minutes left with Celia Hunter on Meet a Pioneer. So you left and took a trip abroad for 8 months, the one we heard about a little bit earlier. And did you come right back to Alaska?
Yeah, we left in September of 47 and came back in December of 48. To Seattle, but we got in touch with Chuck West, and pretty soon we were back in Fairbanks again, working for Chuck at the Empress Theater office at that time. And he had expanded his business considerably during the time that we'd been gone. And the one of the things that it expanded was the Wien Kotzebue tours, because those had started in 1947 as a result of the trip. Ginny and I had made a trip flaring cargo out to Kotzebue in January and February of 1947. We started out from Fairbanks in January 17th, I think, and took us 18 days. We were 18 days in Galena along the way, and then we got weathered in Kotzebue for a week and had become fascinated with that little town. So when we came back, we told a lot of friends about it, and they wanted to go out and see Kotzebue. So we were going to fly them out, but then there were too many of them. They got up, there was more than 20 of them finally, a bunch of teachers and so on. That was the first Wien Kotzebue tour. It was a charter flight, and there were about four or five charter flights in 47 out to Kotzebue. Huh. And then by the time we got back in 1949, they were doing weekly trips to Kotzebue. Every weekend you could go out.
Now, is this what led into your KFAR program called Village Sketches? Your
Oh, yes.
Knowledge of the village, because you flew out to them.
Yeah, well, because the Chuck was in the travel business and handling a lot of business mm-hmm. in Alaska. And in Village Sketches was my idea. I just thought it was interesting. I was like you. I was just fascinated with all of these little villages around Alaska and how they came to be.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we worked for Chuck for that year, and then they, in 1950, went out to... We had to start a roadhouse because Archie Ferguson got mad at tourists along toward the end of 1949 and closed up his roadhouse and Beulah's restaurant. Beulah Levy was the Eskimo gal that he was associated with then, and so we had to start our own roadhouse out there, and so we set up in 1 week. We set up this big old Barney building down on the shore of Kotzebue as a hotel. We had blankets for, it was just like it happened one night, you know, we used blankets for partitions between the bedrooms. We put all the men on one floor and all the women on another floor, and we had to completely redo this building. They'd been repairing engines on one floor and they'd been killing reindeer on another. But we had a week to set it up, and we did. And then in 1950, we went out and stayed in Kotzebue, and then they started daily flights to Kotzebue. And that was a madhouse, if you can imagine, not knowing how many guests you were going to have for dinner and overnight until the airplane circled overhead, because the personnel of Ween didn't like tourists. They thought that was they liked to handle cargo and they liked to handle Eskimos, you know, and just ordinary people, but they didn't like tourists. And so they gave us a hard time. But we stayed out in Kotzebue that whole summer and had daily trips, and we started the Umiak trips, you know, and we'd get the Eskimos to do Eskimo dancing at night. We'd go down and get she-fish from the fishermen to cook for dinner. And it was an exciting time. And in the meantime, when we weren't out there, during 1949, we had also been doing a lot of charter flying for Bob Rice, who had a couple of Navions and checked us out in them. And we'd fly charter for Bob after we got through working for Chuck. And we never did tell Chuck how many hours we were flying every night.
Whoa, gee.
We'd go all over the country here. I remember taking Walt Johnson and up to Wiseman, he and Billy English, who later became probably the best pilot that Ween had. And he and Bill English owned a roadhouse up at Wiseman, so he was going up to set it up for the summer, and we had to fly him up one night. We got up there, must have been 2 o'clock in the morning, and then had to come back and go to work the next day. We did things like that. It was, you know, when you're young, you can do without sleep.
Now, Chuck West offered you some part of the business there to go on into the tour business at one point.
Oh, yeah. Well, we set up the sightseeing. The original sightseeing tours in Fairbanks were started by Ginny and myself back in 1947. Chuck just had an old Plymouth car when he started the Arctic Alaska Travel Service. Some people came in, about four women came in and wanted to go on the sightseeing tour of Fairbanks, and we told them to come back in the afternoon. We didn't have one just then. And when Chuck came in, we said, now, if you only had a decent car, we could take people out sightseeing. And he said, well, just wait a minute, I'll go see what I can do, because Chuck never let any grass grow under his feet. Within 2 hours, he was back with a DeSoto Suburban, which was a great big limousine-type car. He'd been cruising around the streets and saw this car and had a for sale sign on it. The man had driven it up from California, and his wife was not about to drive back over the Alaska Highway. So Chuck made a deal with him and got the limousine and a pair of pants thrown in. And we were in the sightseeing business.
Oh,
well, eventually, in 1949, I guess, he offered to give that part of the business to Jenny and myself, but we said, no thanks. Oh. I'm awfully glad Everett Patton took it. At least he could work on his own buses. We didn't know anything about the innards of buses.
My gosh. Well, we've got just a couple of minutes left, and we never even got to Denali, Camp Denali. We've run out of time. And you want to sum that up in just a few moments? That's a significant thing you started. In just about a minute, I would like you to say something about that.
Well, Camp Denali was our answer to the McKinley Park dilemma of the hotel. We had handled a lot of tourists who came through the McKinley Park area. The hotel is a long way from the mountain. We thought it would be nice if there was a place where people were closer to the mountain where they could, anytime the mountain was visible, you could see it. And we discovered, we located this ridge above Moose Creek and staked the land, which was open public domain land at that time, north of the park boundary, and founded Camp Denali. And we built it from scratch between 1951 and 1975, when we finally sold it to Wally and Jerry Cole, who are operating it now.
You've met Celia Hunter on Meet a Pioneer, an adventure, a fascinating, beautiful woman. Interesting, there's lots more stories, but Celia, thank you very much for being on the program this morning.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
Meet a Pioneer is sponsored by Denali Chiropractic Clinic, Larson's Jewelers, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank, Interior Signs, Sophie Station, Two Rivers Lodge, the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, and the Riverboat Discovery. If you enjoyed the program, be sure to let Celia know. Let us know at KFAR Radio. And thank your sponsors, our sponsors, next time you see them. Celia Hunter on Meet a Pioneer.
Been listening to Meet a Pioneer. A taped version of this interview will become a part of the permanent oral history collection of the Alaskan Polar Regions Department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This program was produced by Gail Malloy.
The report concludes the chances for an uncontrolled leak of MIC gas are very remote, but the government cites two facilities for serious safety problems. One is Union Carbide's plant in Woodbine, Georgia, where the government says maintenance problems present a potentially serious hazard to employees. The second is the FMC facility in Middleport, New York. The government report says the company does not have the equipment they need to stop or neutralize an uncontrolled MIC reaction.
So the bottom line from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration is, chances of a Bhopal-like accident are extremely remote in this country, and there's nothing to stand in the way of those plants operating. Some still question the findings, though, suggesting that the two violations found in Georgia and New York State might indeed be more serious than indicated at first glance by OSHA's report. I'll have more after this.
Pour on the power, go for the glory. This is the story of what you're made of. Give strength, it helps you do it.
Beef alone won't make you strong, but beef does provide protein, iron, and B vitamins. In a balanced diet with plenty of exercise, it gives you a lot to go on.
Beef puts pride in a body. Beef gives strength.
Sponsored by the Beef Industry Council and participating state councils.
Hi, this is Dick Clark with a helpful hint. Don't miss the Dollar Days sale going on right now at your participating Valurite pharmacy. You'll find dozens of outstanding savings like this one on Asper Cream, a soothing analgesic cream rub that helps provide temporary relief from occasional minor pain due to arthritis, rheumatism, or muscular aches without taking aspirin. A 3-ounce tube of Asper Cream is only $2.50 during Valurite's Dollar Days sale. Use only as directed. Just check the yellow pages for the Valurite pharmacy nearest you and tell them Dick Clark sent you.
The State Department has welcomed American journalist Jeremy Levin's freedom from his Lebanese kidnappers, no matter how it happened. And there's some dispute about it, or at least a little leftover confusion, ABC's Herbert Kaplow reports.
The U.S. publicly expressed its appreciation today for Syria's help in the release of journalist Jeremy Levin. Positive is the way a State Department spokesman characterized Syria's role. It is still not clear just how Levin got away. He says he escaped. The Syrians indicate they negotiated his release. One theory here at the State Department is that Syria may have managed to arrange that Levin be allowed to escape. All this happens against the backdrop of relations that deteriorated severely between Syria and the United States over recent years. Meanwhile, the State Department says it is continuing to work quietly for the release of four other Americans who disappeared in Lebanon a little more than a year ago. Herbert Kaplow, ABC News at the State Department.
Treasury Secretary Baker told reporters today that the United States has been intervening of late in the world currency markets, intervening more frequently, that is, than is usual. Baker says the idea is to keep the dollar from rising so far and fast that it is disruptive to our own and other economies. Humana Hospital announced today that a local Louisville man will undergo an artificial heart operation Sunday. Hospital spokesman Bob Irvine identified the man as retired factory worker, 58-year-old Murray Hayden.
His family is a very quiet family.
Yukon Quest. I'm Steve Agbaba. You're listening to Agbaba at Large in Alaska.
More with Agbaba talking about Alaska following the news.
Ohio Governor Richard Celeste already has signed a bill approved in the state Senate a little over an hour ago that will lead to the reopening as early as later today of some of Ohio's state chartered savings and loans. The bill was an amended version of one rejected in the Senate 24 hours earlier. What cleared the way for Ohio State Senate approval was House action in easing a requirement that all SNLs have federal deposit insurance. The president of the Senate, Paul Gilmore, was pleased with the change.
I wish the bill had, the House had sent us a bill more along this line yesterday, because we could have had a bill passed yesterday. But we now have that bill that we have all agreed with as a good approach, and I'm happy to see it passed.
The new approach that Senator Gilmore mentioned was the fact that some of the smaller institutions, which might not qualify for federal insurance, also would be protected by the bill. I'll have more after this.
By now, your IRA has probably turned into quite a nice little nest egg.
4,005, 6, 7.
So now it's more important than ever to make your IRA work harder. Dean Witter offers you dozens of investments that could make it grow faster. So talk to an account executive at any Dean Witter branch or Sears Financial Network Center, or call 1-800-THE-DEAN for a free IRA kit. Dean Witter could help your little nest egg get a whole lot bigger.
8,000, 9,000.
Dean Witter, a member of the Sears Financial Network.
Folks can be hard on their AT&T phones.
I want to talk to Grandma!
Let me talk!
Hello?
Here, it's for you. Oops. So we make them tough enough for lots of hellos and goodbyes.
Bye now.
I gotta run.
Toodaloo.
Good day. And it's nice to know that if anything does go wrong, when you lease your phones, we'll replace them free on the spot at one of our AT&T consumer sales and service phone centers. We don't ever want to hang you up.
History of this special place we call Alaska, and we look forward to each week's program. We're looking forward to seeing you again next summer aboard the Riverboat Discovery.
Okay, we're back with Celia Hunter on Meet a Pioneer. Well, Celia, you called up a fellow. Turns out he had a plane. He had one for your friend, and you're going to fly him into Alaska. Let's pick up at that point in the story.
Well, you know, it was kind of interesting because this all started about September of 1946, which is not a bad month to head north to Alaska.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, we were not aware of anything about the weather in Alaska and the winter in Alaska or anything like that. We'd only been temperate zone pilots so far. The Jean Jack had lots of irons in the fire, and he sent us out to do all sorts of things. This was kind of interesting. He'd get an idea, and Rollie Lively was his partner in a lot of this stuff. And Rollie Lively used to run the Fairbanks Cold Storage. Anybody who remembers Fairbanks in the 40s will remember the Cold Storage. It was at Wickersham and Second or something like that. Anyway, they were down there in Seattle dreaming up ways to make money because the Alaska steamship was out on strike just then. So they decided to buy a truck, a big semi, and send it up the highway with liquor and meat and all kinds of things to make money. And so he just said, well, why don't you girls go out and see if whether this is a good truck or not. He found one in the want ads, and so we went out and we looked at it, and we didn't know anything about trucks, but it looked good, so we said, okay. And he sent us out to get a darkroom outfit for his trading post in Kotzebue, because he decided that was how he'd make some money. You know, he'd sell cameras to the Eskimos and then anyway, and we bought calico for parkies. We'd never seen a cuss puck in our life, but we were out buying calico to make cuss pucks for the Eskimos in Kotzebue. And at one point, he asked us if we were checked out on B-17s. Well, Jenny had checked out on a B-17 at one time in the ferry command. And he said, well, I was thinking about buying a B-17 and sending it up there. We said, no way. Not us. But so we We had to do a lot of work on the airplanes and so on. So it was getting on into November, and we still hadn't left Seattle.
Oh, my.
And finally, it was December 8th of 1946 that we headed north for Fairbanks. Now, Gene, he'd been up here through many winters, and that was nothing to him. And he threw a fire pot in my airplane, and he said, "Now, this is how we start the airplane when it gets cold." And I said, "With that thing?" And he said, "Oh, yeah." And he went through a quick rundown of what you do with a fire pot. Do you know what a fire pot is?
I have no idea.
Well, a fire pot is an oversized plumber's. It's a Prima stove. It's operated with gasoline, and it's a great big thing.